The Ulster Economics Podcast. The podcast that keeps you up to date with what is happening economy-wise in Northern Ireland. Telling you what you need to know, but not necessarily what you want to hear. It is better to be prepared for the economic environment we're operating in and not the world we would like to be in. Episode 13, Cost of Living Crisis 2, the sequel. COVID lockdowns meant that 2020 was a year to forget for the filmmaking industry and the movie-watching public. No Time to Die, the latest film in the James Bond franchise, was delayed three times because of the pandemic. Unlike 2020, this year has seen a steady stream of much-anticipated sequels being released, such as Top Gun Maverick, Mission Impossible 7, and last month's Halloween Kills. Spider-Man 3 and Matrix 4 are also slated for release in December, and next year we can look forward to Scream 5 and Legally Blonde 3, or so I'm told. Some sequels use the same cast and rehash plot lines as the original. Others introduce new characters and new storylines to engage the audience and to keep the story fresh. In the economics world, there are plenty of sequels too. Whether it is stock market crashes, recessions, or financial crises. Invariably, with economic sequels, there are similarities with the original, but there can also be notable differences. The latest economic box office release doing the rounds is The Cost of Living Crisis 2. This is the sequel to the squeeze on living standards that took place between 2008 and 2014, particularly over the period late 2009 to late 2013. This was a sustained period when consumer price inflation significantly outpaced pay growth. It was also a period of austerity with a scaling back of welfare benefits, multi-year benefit freezes and public sector pay caps. Back in 2013, Ed Miliband, the former Labour leader, focused on the worst cost of living crisis to hit Britain since the 1920s. The issue was the centrepiece of his unsuccessful attempt to overthrow David Cameron in the 2015 general election. Unfortunately for Miliband, the cost of living started to improve in 2014 and 2015, and thus hurt his campaign to become Prime Minister. Moving back to the present day, once again the cost of living crisis is becoming the top political issue. Around the world, households are being hit with inflation rates not seen in several years or indeed several decades. Food and energy prices are soaring, housing is becoming less affordable, and incomes are being squeezed. In the US, consumer price inflation hit 6.2% year-on-year in October. That's its highest rate since 1990, 2 years before I opened my first economics textbook. According to some, the cost of last week's traditional Thanksgiving dinner is up 14% year-on-year, with the traditional turkey dinner up 25% relative to pre-pandemic levels in 2019. Turkey and carrot prices are up one-third relative to 2019's Thanksgiving holiday. But it's not just food inflation. US inflation is broad-based, covering food, energy, and used cars. Furniture inflation is at a 70-year high. Inflation has also led Dollar Tree, which is the US equivalent of Poundland, to raise most of its prices by 25% from $1 to $1.25. Dollar Tree had kept prices at just $1 for the past 35 years. In Germany, the price of manufacturing goods leaving the factory gate hit over 18% year-on-year in October. That represents the highest rate of inflation in almost 70 years. Meanwhile, German consumer prices rose by 4.6% last month, marking the steepest annual rise in 28 years. Closer to home, the Republic of Ireland has seen CPI inflation accelerate to 5.1% in October, its highest rate since April 2007. And in the UK, CPI reached 4.2% year-on-year for October, which is near a decade high. As with the US, the UK's source of inflation is broad-based, with energy accounting for a disproportionate share. While it represents just 6% of the CPI basket for consumer goods and services, it accounted for almost one-third of the current inflation rate. To give you a flavour of some of the other recent price rises in the latest CPI figures, electricity is up almost 19% Gas is up 28% year on year. And in Northern Ireland, we have heard in the last fortnight that the largest electricity supplier, Power NI, will be increasing electricity prices by 21% in January. Meanwhile, Firmus recently announced a 38% increase in its gas tariff for its 10 towns network. Motor fuels, which is petrol and diesel, they have risen by almost 22% year on year in October and are currently at record highs, with diesel already breaching the 150 pence per litre mark. Home heating oil is 69% higher in October 2021 relative to a year ago. Second-hand car prices are up almost 23% over the year, and they're up by 27% since April. Food price inflation remains relatively tame at 1.3% year on year. Bear in mind, in 2008, it averaged 10%, but it's expected to increase above 4% in the coming months. Old school inflation aficionados will have noted that the retail price index measure hit 6% year on year in October, its highest level since 1991. The UK is expected to see its rate of CPI exceed 5% in the coming months, and we expect a peak of around 5.2% next spring. That will match the peaks recorded in both September 2008 and September 2011. The old retail price index measure should breach 7% next spring, and October's higher than expected CPI reading and more favourable labour market data could trigger the first December Bank of England interest rate hike since 1994. But the recent arrival of the Omicron variant could delay this first hike. Up until now, the Bank of England, alongside the Federal Reserve in the US and the European Central Bank, have been loath to take up the role of inflation busters just yet. It is worth remembering that inflation hits those on lower incomes disproportionately hard. As illustrated in the last cost of living crisis, Northern Ireland was hit disproportionately harder than other UK regions. This was due to the fact that Northern Ireland has the highest proportion of low-paid jobs in the UK, currently almost one in five. It is the lowest discretionary disposable income within the UK, and Northern Ireland households also spend disproportionately higher amounts of their income on energy, food, petrol and diesel relative to the rest of the UK. Improving the standard of living is like a game of snakes and ladders. If pay exceeds the rate of inflation and any tax changes, an individual or economy advances their standard of living, or alternatively, they will see their cost of living fall. During the noughties, pay rises consistently outpaced inflation, effectively providing Northern Ireland and UK workers with a foot up the standard of living ladder. Following the global financial crisis, there was a surge in inflation, and ultimately this led to a huge cost of living snake, with the median annual wage of a private sector full-time worker in Northern Ireland falling by 12% in real terms between 2008 and 2013. That equated to a fall of £3,000 per full-time worker. From 2013 until the start of the pandemic, Northern Ireland's workers have been clawing back their fall in real earnings and improving their standard of living. Some sections of the workforce, notably those working part-time, have benefited more from the inflation-busting increases in the national minimum wage, or now known as the national living wage. By 2019, private sector wages for full-time employees had almost returned to their 2008 level when adjusting for inflation, but the pandemic has seen real wages fall back again. It is noted that the median wage for a full-time private sector worker is now on a par with where it was back in 2007 at £25,500. And once again, we're at the start of another big cost of living snake, with inflation set to outpace wage growth in the next couple of years. While the rate of inflation is set to come down in the second half of next year, we're still expecting to see CPI inflation average around 4.6% in 2022 and 2.7% in 2023. These figures are likely to exceed wage increases for most workers. It is not just inflation that will squeeze consumers' incomes in the year ahead, increased taxation will too. This is a key difference with the last cost of living crisis. Just to give an example of the combined effects of the expected increase in inflation and the increase in tax, according to the Institute for Fiscal Studies, an individual with a salary of £30,000 in April 2021 will require a nominal wage growth of 7.1% to maintain the same standard of living, given the forecast of a 5% annual inflation forecast plus the changes in the national insurance contributions. There are another couple of differences between this cost of living crisis and the last one. On a positive note, the labour market is in much better shape, with the unemployment rate currently 4%, less than half of its peak during the last cost of living crisis, where it was about 8.3%, 8.4%. And there are a record number of job vacancies currently. As a result, most employers will not be able to pacify staff with a pay freeze, unlike what they did a decade ago. On a negative note, the last cost of living crisis did not have to contend with Brexit. The Brexit debate has moved on to the Northern Ireland Protocol debate. The Northern Ireland Protocol has already provided significant benefits to many local companies, indeed dual access to the UK single market and the EU single market for goods has been a factor behind ALMAC's 1,000 new jobs announcement and news that AMP's plans, with AMP being one of the world's biggest packaging firms, announcing it was going to build a major new beverage can factory near Belfast by 2023. Notwithstanding these successes and many others, the best of both worlds Northern Ireland Protocol narrative wrongly suggests that the new arrangements are unambiguously positive. The access to both markets clearly is, but Brexit and its outworking through the protocol add new regulations, new bureaucracy and new costs. The new regulatory sea border is not the best of any world. It is a vehicle to deliver Brexit. Brexit's costs are well known but haven't fully arrived yet. In time, businesses will pass these on to consumers. Therefore, anything that adds to the cost of consumer goods will impact significantly on Northern Ireland's economic growth outlook. Another factor affecting the cost of living in the future will be the cost of adapting to climate change. Clearly, the cost of solar panels, heat pumps and electric vehicles and adapting to this is not going to be costless. And this is going to be a major factor which will add to potential inflationary pressures for consumers in the years ahead. So if we look to the near term, as far as cost of living crisis is concerned, we will be closely watching and listening to what the weather forecasters have to say, because if it is a very cold winter, that will increase demand for gas and increase electricity and energy prices, which is what we do not want to see. So this year, more than any other year, we want a very mild winter. It's not just the weather forecasters we'll be watching, it's also the epidemiologists. Over the last 18 months or so, we have watched the various mutant sequels to COVID-19, from Alpha, Beta, Delta, and now on to Omicron. What does or doesn't happen with these variants is clearly going to have a significant impact on the economy, either in a positive or negative way. Okay, so if we turn to the economy and the various survey news, with turning first of all to the PMI survey for October, the latest report produced for Ulster Bank by IHS Markit signalled that surging price rises acted as a brake on the Northern Ireland private sector in October, restricting growth of business activity and contributing to a decrease in new orders. The business activity index slowed from 54.2 in September to 52.2 in October, and this compared with an acceleration in private sector growth in both the UK and the Republic of Ireland. Northern Ireland firms reported their second successive month of falling orders, and this contrasted with strong rates of new orders growth amongst UK and Republic of Ireland private sector firms. Demand from export markets remains particularly weak, with export orders falling significantly in October. It was a reading of 44.9, and that's the 33rd successive month of decline. This clearly jars with some of the North-South trade data, which points to a North-South import or export boom. And what this is implying is that trade volumes may be up due to a minority of firms benefiting rather than the vast majority of firms seeing an increase. Both input costs and output prices amongst Northern Ireland firms rose at new record rates, with suppliers' delivery times continuing to lengthen. On a more positive note, local companies expanded their staffing levels at a sharp and accelerated pace. And at a sector level, manufacturing remains a star performer with robust rates of growth in output, new orders, and employment is growing at a record rate. A services slowdown now looks in train, with output slowing and orders falling for the first time in 6 months. Once again, local retailers and construction firms, they posted declines in output, orders and employment levels. The key theme in the Ulster Bank Northern Ireland PMI was slower rates of growth and higher inflation, a trend that is expected to continue in the coming months. Turning to the labour market, the biggest dog that didn't bark during the pandemic-induced recession has been unemployment. And you can thank Rishi Sunak's job retention scheme or furlough scheme for that. Following the end of the furlough scheme on the 30th of September, the latest statistics from NISRA suggest that the local economy has secured a relatively soft landing. Labour market data for October highlights that unemployment, that's a claimant count measure, continued to fall, with the number of people claiming unemployment-related benefits down to 47,000. That's the eighth successive monthly decline, and it is down 26% since last year's post-pandemic peak. Despite this decline, the claimant count is still 54% above the pre-pandemic level recorded in March 2020 of 30,500. Unlike last year, redundancies remain few and far between. There were just 240 proposed redundancies between August and October. Meanwhile, the number of employees on HMRC payrolls hit 768,188 in October. That marked the fifth consecutive monthly record high, and this represented an increase of 4.4% year-on-year, which exceeded the 4% growth rate for the UK. The total number of employees on local payrolls has now risen 2.1%, or just over 15,600 employees, above the pre-pandemic levels. That represents the strongest employment performance of any UK region, and it is more than double the increase for the UK as a whole. While the total number of employees in Northern Ireland's payrolls is back above pre-pandemic levels, it has been an unbalanced recovery. In numerical terms, recovery has been driven disproportionately by the public sector. For example, education and health and social work have accounted for three quarters of the gain in jobs relative to March 2020's pre-pandemic level. There have been outstanding performances by some other sectors, notably information and communication, which includes ICT. It's increased its headcount by 10% between March 2020 and October of this year. Sectors that have witnessed a reduction in their headcount include other service sector activities, arts, entertainment and recreation. It's noted in another piece of research from Arts Council NI that one quarter of the arts workforce has been lost due to COVID-19. Wholesale and retail has also seen a near 2% reduction in its headcount, and manufacturing has lost over 1,100 jobs since the start of the pandemic. It's also worth noting that the recovery in employment has differed vastly by employment status. Employee levels may be back above pre-pandemic levels. However, self-employment in the third quarter of 2021 remains a hefty 28% below Q4 2019 levels. The slump in self-employment largely explains the fact that the total hours worked in Northern Ireland in the third quarter of 2021 is still 9.4% below the pre-pandemic high of 26.9 million hours in Q2 2019. Furthermore, the recovery in hours worked appears to have stalled in the latest quarter between Q3 and Q2, with the number of hours worked falling by 2.4% relative to Q2. Ultimately, for a full labour market recovery to be declared, the total number of hours worked will need to return to pre-pandemic levels. While there may be some unfavourable bumps in the incoming data in the coming months, it is beyond doubt that the furlough scheme has probably been the best pandemic policy in the world. As far as protecting jobs and preventing mass unemployment, this policy has exceeded all expectations. Rather than a surge in job losses, we have witnessed a surge in job vacancies with record levels of job opportunities. Looking at the tourist industry, hotel occupancy figures have been on the rise since the hospitality sector's reopening in May. August saw a respectable 78% for room occupancy, and that has eased back, as expected, to 68% for September. That compares with 74% occupancy pre-pandemic in September 2019, and September's record rates of occupancy were 83% in both 2016 and 2017. Northern Ireland's hotels reported over 196,000 rooms sold in September. That is almost five times the total for May, which was the first month of reopening, but it is still 7.5% below the pre-pandemic room sales recorded in September 2019. Returning to pre-pandemic occupancy rates this winter is unlikely, given that lockdown restrictions of some description look increasingly likely by the day. Just moving to the new car market, 2020 saw the number of new car sales in Northern Ireland plummet by 30% year on year to a series low. A post-lockdown recovery began in the second half of last year, but supply chain disruptions, particularly semiconductor shortages, have acted as a handbrake on the recovery ever since. Throughout 2021, local dealers have posted some of their weakest months of sales on record, and October has been no exception, with the weakest October on record, and sales were down 23% below last October's figure, and they're one-fifth below 2019's pre-pandemic level. If we look at the year-to-date, for the first 10 months of the year, sales are up just a modest 4% year-on-year, but are 30% below the corresponding 10-month period in 2019. With just 2 months remaining, 2021 is set for something like last year's record low, and the reduced supply of new stock flowing into the used car market will continue to push up prices of second-hand cars. If we move to the property market, Northern Ireland's Residential Property Price Index reported its 10th successive quarter of growth in the third quarter, with price declines occurring in only two of the last 34 quarters. So over the 8.5-year period, prices have increased by 63%. If we look at the 3 months to September, local prices increased by 3% quarter on quarter, which took the standardised price of a residential property in Northern Ireland to £159,100. That's a 13-year high, and standardised prices increased by 10.7% year on year, which is on a par with the Republic of Ireland and above the UK growth rate of 9.8%. Since the onset of the pandemic, local residential property prices have increased by 13.1%, or that equates to £235 per week. We have perhaps become blasé again in thinking that prices can only go one way. It is worth remembering, though, prices may be above pre-pandemic levels, but they're still 29% below Q3 2007's freak peak of £224,670. That figure doesn't take account of inflation. Adjusting for inflation, Q3 2007's peak is £308,000 in today's money, nearly double the price of houses 14 years later. Other key points from the latest Residential Property Price Index revealed that existing properties in Northern Ireland, or second-hand properties, increased by 11.9% year-on-year. That was more than double the rise for new dwellings. Terraced and detached properties both recorded double-digit year-on-year price rises, with 13.3% for terraces and 11.6% for detached. Semi-detached prices rose by just under 10%, with apartments up only 3.4% year-on-year in the third quarter. The detached market saw its best nine-month period, Q1 to Q3, for transactions in 15 years. Sales jumped 83% year-on-year and are up over one-third relative to 2019's Q1 to Q3 period, which is pre-pandemic. This surge has been dubbed the race for space. The semi-detached market has also recorded its best Q1 to Q3 in 15 years, with sales up by 67%, while the terraced and apartment sectors, they posted their best sales for the corresponding period in 15 years. It is not just prices and transactions that are above pre-pandemic levels. House building activity is too. If we look at housing starts for the first three quarters of 2021, they're up 38% year-on-year, and they are 11% higher relative to the more meaningful benchmark of first 9 months of 2019. Finished dwellings, or house completions as they're known, for the first 9 months of the year are up 30% year on year, but they're only up marginally at 2% above the corresponding period for 2019. The 5,560 dwellings completed so far this year does represent the highest total since 2009. However, headwinds for the construction industry and house building have intensified in recent quarters. Building materials prices have been rising at record rates, and the PMI surveys for the UK, Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland have highlighted that supply delivery times have lengthened to record levels. As a result, the current demand, which is seen to be excessive relative to supply mismatch, won't change anytime soon. And indeed, it could still get worse. It is arguably the worst time to be building a house in a generation due to the material shortages, inflation and uncertainty and ongoing disruption. It is worth noting that house completions in the third quarter of 2021 did fall by 3% year on year. This could be the start of a sequence of year on year declines in completions as inflationary pressures and supply chain bottlenecks bite. 2021 could well represent the high point, with lower levels of activity anticipated in 2022. Longer term challenges such as the lack of zoned land, inadequate infrastructure such as water sewerage, and delays within the planning system add to the inflationary headwinds. Looking ahead to December, we have a number of key releases. As always, there will be the monthly PMI for Northern Ireland, and we'll be closely watching to see whether the trend of slower growth and higher rates of inflation continues. Also, the cost of living crisis will remain in focus with the November's UK CPI inflation data, which will have more of the increases in energy prices feeding through. We would expect to see the annual inflation rate jump from 4.2% year on year to about 4.8%. But probably the key release of the month or event is going to be the Bank of England's meets to decide on its monetary policy settings, and it didn't increase rates in November when the financial markets did think it was going to do that. Now it looks more likely that it could move and increase rates during the month of December for the first time since 1994. Perhaps the only fly in the ointment has been what has happened on the COVID-19 front with the arrival of a new variant, the Omicron variant, and the Bank of England may choose to sit and wait to see how that pans out before they move on the first hike in interest rates. So when we're looking ahead at the various economic data releases coming in, it's going to be as much as what the epidemiologists say on the evolving situation as regards to Omicron. I am Richard Ramsay, and this has been episode 13, Cost of Living Crisis 2, the sequel, of the Ulster Economics podcast. You can stay up to date on ulstereconomics.com or follow us on social media. In the coming weeks, we'll be doing another podcast of a review of the year and outlook for 2022. Until then.